Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody. Oh, goodness. Got a great show for you today. I'll give you a quick little run through here. I got quite a bit on Hillary versus Bernie. Hillary's trying to bob and weave her way out of a new debate with Bernie in New York. Of course, Hillary Clinton was the senator from New York, and Bernie Sanders has the potential to be competitive here, and so he wants to get his word out more and debate her here in New York. And she's like, I don't know about that. So I'll tell you what the new line of argument is from the Hillary camp. It's pretty sad if I don't say so myself. Then also we have the phrases that are repeated most often by the different campaigns, by Hillary and by Sanders. And I mean, you want to talk about proving a point. I think this overwhelmingly proves what we've been saying from the beginning, that Bernie is just only focused on policy substance, whereas Hillary is packed full of flowery rhetoric. And then later on in the show, we have good news coming out of California in terms of the minimum wage. We have an attempted terror attack that was foiled. And we have a UN summit on the drug war, and some interesting news. The snowball effect is currently happening. So what that means is, you know, there was a little bit of movement in the right direction, and then a little bit more, and then now you have prominent figures coming out and saying, okay, this is kind of bullshit. We got to move away from this whole drug war thing. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get started here. And I'm going to kick it off with a litany of Hillary-Bernie stories because there's a lot to get to. Okay. So Hillary Clinton's campaign is trying to bob and weave their way out of a new debate with Bernie Sanders in New York, the state where she was a senator. Talking Points memo reports here. When asked on Monday whether Hillary Clinton would agree to debate Senator Bernie Sanders in New York, the Clinton campaign's chief strategist said the campaign would consider it if Sanders changes his tone. And this is his direct quote. He continues here. This is a man who said he'd never run a negative ad, ever. He's now running them. They're planning to run more. Let's see the tone of the campaign if he wants to run before we get to any other questions. What's the risk? There is no risk. She's done well in the debates. But Senator Sanders doesn't get to decide when we debate, particularly when he's running a very negative campaign against us. Let's see if he goes back to the kind of tone and he said he was going to when he said early on. If he does that, then we'll talk about debates. Oh boy. When I read that, you know what I was reminded of? Donald Trump. Because that sounds exactly like Trump. You know, I would appear on your show, but I'm not so sure that your tone is in favor of me. You know, I get the feeling that you're being too harsh against me, and this isn't right. And furthermore, isn't it funny that in the mind of the Hillary campaign, it's negative because Bernie's daring to point out what she actually does? Well, that would lead me to the conclusion that perhaps you shouldn't have done it in the first place. That it's not Bernie's fault for pointing out your record and what you've done and the money you take from Wall Street. It's your fault for doing it in the first place. But they say, oh no, if you bring up the facts, well, then we have a problem. Then we have an issue. You know, then you're portraying me in a negative light by explaining to people what I actually did, and that cannot stand. We cannot have that. Change your tone and then we'll move forward. This is what the Democrats were saying in the Senate recently. There were a bunch of Senate Democrats who came to Hillary's defense, and they said, well, we're not saying Bernie should drop out, but we are saying that perhaps if he wants to stay in, he should focus his attacks more on the Republican Party. Shouldn't focus it on Hillary Clinton. Well, isn't that telling? So you're not allowed to attack her. Even if you want to run a campaign against her, it has to be all flowers and puppies, and you have to agree that the Republicans are the biggest problem, and you can't bring up the things that are relevant against her. God, that's so telling, man, the kind of Democrat that she is. And here comes somebody who's actually principled and who actually cares about the policy substance and who's running an entire campaign based on that, and it's considered negative. And who's really been negative all along? It's Hillary's campaign that's gone with the Bernie Bros narrative and, you know, has tried to make these hacky arguments about his character. Whereas, again, what Senator Sanders is doing is he's just pointing out, oh, you took this money from Goldman Sachs. Methinks there's a connection between the policies you'll implement and the money you took. So everything he's saying is very straightforward and accurate, and he can point to, you know, things that she pushed for that prove it. Whereas everything she says is just a hacky, cheap personal attack, and then their campaign manager has the nerve to turn around and say, how dare you? You're besmirching her great legacy. Tone down a little, and then maybe we'll debate. They're in the middle of a campaign! And again, Bernie Sanders said he'd never run a negative campaign ad. Well, he hasn't. Because the thing is, his negative attack ads are just pointing out facts, and it's not, you know, it's not maligning her personally. It's not talking about the things that the Republicans would talk about when they talk about personal attacks, like, oh, Monica Lewinsky and shit like that. He would never do that. He's issues focused, and that's why they're scared. They're scared because it's working. They're scared because they see that it's having an effect. They're scared because they know that that can resonate. They're scared because maybe now they understand that this is a similar strategy that Obama used when Obama came up from her left. Now, Bernie's coming up further from her left, but that would possibly help him even more. So they're nervous, and on Twitter, after this, there was a hashtag, tone down for what? So everybody who's following this election, they understand what's going on here, and they're getting their voice heard. And Bernie Sanders started getting even more aggressive after this development. So Hillary Clinton tweeted support for the $15 minimum wage that just came up in California. And Bernie tweeted right back at her and said, yeah, but here's the difference. I actually support a $15 minimum wage. You don't. So, how are you going to praise that, Hillary, if you're not in favor of it? And she'll wiggle her way out of it and say, well, that's at the state level they're doing it. I'm saying at the federal level it should be 12, but at the state, if they want to make it 15, they can make it 15 and I support it. Yeah, but the bottom line is, in principle, you don't support a $15 minimum wage across the board. He does. So he's right when he says that back to you. But I know, if you point that out, oh my God, you're going negative by pointing out reality. Well, if you think that's negative, then maybe that shouldn't have been your position in the first place. Maybe you should agree with him in the first place. Logic doesn't count. Throw it out the window. Don't you be mean to her. If you're mean to her when you're running a campaign against her, well, then we're going to have to not debate you. This is the kind of thing we're dealing with now. Okay, so there's one little aspect to the feud that we're doing here. Let's continue along, and I got more for you. Now, Jill Abramson came to the defense of Hillary Clinton in the most ridiculous way I've ever seen in my life. You're going to have to read the whole article at The Guardian, but let me lay this out for you, and I will absolutely obliterate her argument. Jill Abramson, who is the former executive director, it's editor, not director. I like how when my mind just makes up words to replace other words, that's always cute. Jill Abramson, who is the former executive editor of the New York Times, wrote an article about Hillary Clinton, and it's embarrassing. So she says the following. For decades, she's been portrayed as a Lady Macbeth involved in nefarious plots, branded as a congenital liar and accused of covering up her husband's misconduct, from Arkansas to Monica Lewinsky. Some of this is sexist caricature. Some is stoked by the Hillary is a liar videos that flood Facebook feeds. Some of it she brings on herself by insisting on a perimeter or zone of privacy that she protects too fiercely. It's a natural impulse, given the level of scrutiny she's attracted, more than any male politician I can think of. I'm not a favorite in Hillary land. That makes what I want to say next surprising. Hillary Clinton is fundamentally honest and trustworthy. She continues, ever since I was an investigative reporter covering the nexus of money in politics, I've looked for connections between money, including campaign donations, loans, super PAC funds, speaking fees, foundation ties, and actions. I'm on the lookout for lies, scrutinizing statements candidates make in the heat of an election. It was colossally stupid to take those hefty speaking fees, but not corrupt. There are no instances I know of where Clinton was doing the bidding of a donor or benefactor. Okay, now I'm going to come back to that last part in a second here, but first let me address the beginning of the argument. This is something that I've now come to call McFeminism. Now, I actually did not come up with that term. I wish I did because it's fucking awesome. But I believe it was Adam Johnson of Alternet who came up with it, or at least he's the first person I saw use it on Twitter in reference to a similar thing where there was accusation of Bernie bros flying around. And the idea of McFeminism is that it's feminism that's about as close to feminism as the meat in the chicken nuggets is to actual chicken. Like, there's the stories of how, yeah, the Chicken McNuggets are really the kind of meat you want to be eating. It's kind of fake and, you know, full with all the disgusting parts. Right, that's exactly what we're talking about here. McFeminism is watered-down, disgusting, knockoff feminism that kind of besmirches actual feminism because it's just the hackiest argument you can imagine where you effectively say, as some have said in this debate, that, well, no, you... By definition, because Hillary's a woman, you must support her, or you're a bad person. I think it was Madeleine Albright who said there's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women. And that's the argument she was using for voting for Hillary over Bernie Sanders. That's amazing. By that logic, you have to support Carly Fiorina over Bernie Sanders if it came down to it. Or you have to support Sarah Palin over Bernie Sanders. That ain't feminism. That's McFeminism. It's embarrassing. And it's very closely tied to what's now called third-wave feminism or neo-feminism, which is the idea that you kind of nitpick and look for arguments that aren't really policy substance-based. It's just, you know, pulling the sexism card at every possible turn. Another example that I always think is hilarious is the way you portray women in video games is sexist. Yes, the worst problem facing society today is the portrayals of women in video games. This is what you care about? I mean, there are things to really care about in the world. That's it. That's the sexist. McFeminism, that's what it is. And I like how she, just a little dash of it here. You know, Hillary, she's under more scrutiny than any male politician I can think of. So that's a way to assert, well, it's only based on her gender, without even providing any evidence. It's like, I don't know, I'm just going to assert that it's worse than any scrutiny any male politician has ever been under. Well, can you prove that? Do you have examples? No, I'm not going to do that, but I'm just going to assert it, and you have to accept it as true or you're sexist. So there's a little sprinkle of it, and it's just a sexist caricature to talk about her integrity. And what you're doing is you're rigging the deck. You're rigging the game here where you say, well, now you're suspect if you criticize her in any way, even if it's policy-based, you're suspect. Why? Because I just said that, hey, this is a sexist caricature when you talk about her in this way. So it's almost like she's trying to give her a special category on her own above criticism. And she puts her there so that whenever anybody says anything, you just brush it off as, well, that what do you expect? Sexist is going to be sexist. So what are you going to do? They're the problem. It's not what Hillary does. Well, then again, she can get away with anything and then hide behind that, and then you'd be defending her. So it is just utterly ridiculous. Now, going beyond that, When you make the point, there are no instances I know of where Clinton was doing the bidding of a donor or a benefactor. And she says, I'm really interested in money and politics, and I try to follow it, but hey, I looked, I can't find anything. There's no other way to break this down other than to say you're either stupid or you're a liar. Because you say you looked for it. I'm going to take you at your word. I looked for it. I couldn't find it. Whoa, look at that. I tried, but there's nothing there. There's no evidence. Look away, look away, look away. Okay, so either you're terrible at looking for it, which means you suck at your job, which means you never should have been the executive editor at the New York Times, or you're just lying. You see it and you're like, I'm going to cover up because I like her and she's my candidate, so I'm just going to cover up for her. So let's dig in here. Examples of Hillary Clinton doing the bidding of donors. Numero uno. She takes money from Wall Street and she's against Glass-Steagall and breaking up the big banks. That's a huge one. Now, we know economists have told us, experts have told us, hey, one of the main things that led to the subprime mortgage crisis in the Great Recession was when we got rid of Glass-Steagall and the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. By the way, signed by Bill Clinton. She supported it at the time, too. She also supported NAFTA. So this idea, oh, I'm for the working class. Yeah, sign the deal that's going to ship out all the jobs. You're going to tell me money has no effect on any of this stuff? Please. So she takes money from Wall Street. She takes money from the big banks. Lo and behold, her plan, regardless of how she tries to frame it, is significantly weaker than Bernie Sanders' plan. She says the opposite half the time. Time she's like, no, it is more pragmatic, and it is more what we can do. Then the other half of time, she's like, I go further than him. But then when you actually read her plan, you go, oh, this is nowhere near as far as Bernie Sanders. He wants to break him up today. And he also wants to bring back Glass-Steagall today. She's against that. Okay, one example. Second one. The Clinton Foundation took money from Saudi Arabia. What happened directly after that? She turned around as Secretary of State, and she approved a weapons deal for them. So, no approval. Oh, you just gave some money to the Clinton Foundation? Now I will approve your weapons deal. And then they celebrated it in internal emails. They said it's a nice Christmas gift to give weapons to this Salafi terror state, which turned around and bombed the shit out of Yemen and killed massive numbers of civilians. More, Hillary Clinton, in emails, pitched the Iraq war, I kid you not, as, quote, a business opportunity for U.S. corporations. Tell me again how money doesn't affect her. Under what conceivable scenario would any rational human being say that, unless there's an incentive structure in the system which pushes her to say stuff like that? Hey, this is a business opportunity. Illegal war with the wrong country where we're killing civilians? A business opportunity for U.S. corporations. I wonder if she says that because those corporations gave her money, so she has to look out for them. Hard one. More. She opposed, and this is coming from directly from Elizabeth Warren. So please, give me more. She must be sexist when she said this. She opposed a pro-corporate bankruptcy bill. Okay, and she even convinced Bill Clinton not to sign that bill. And then later on, when she became a senator, she supported it after taking money from lobbyists. That's like a fucking science experiment on corruption. When she's not taking the money, when she's first lady, she sits down with Elizabeth Warren. Oh my God, you're right. This bankruptcy bill is biased in favor of corporations. I can't have Bill sign this. Let me go talk to him. Let's figure all this stuff out. So she was against it. Fast forward to after she took money from those special interests. Now she's for it. She votes for it as a senator. Unbelievable. She was also in favor of a single-payer healthcare system, and now she opposes it after taking millions from the health industry. Okay? And finally, let me just leave you with this amazing fact. When you take into account the money that Bill raised when he was running for president, the money that she's raised in her presidential runs, the money that they've raised for their respective super PACs, the money that they've taken through the Clinton Foundation, and the money that they've taken in personal speaking fees from big corporations. How much have they done in fundraising over the course of their careers, the Clinton family? $3 billion. Now, if you want to make the argument that, hey, you go around to special interests, to giant corporations, to moneyed interests, to elites, you raise all that money, and no, they don't want anything from you, I'm going to need you to take a hike. Because that is a preposterous position. And again, you're either unbelievably ignorant or you're stupid, or you're lying. Those are the only possible options. So your argument just bit off more than it can chew. It's a ridiculous argument. Even somebody who's not as well-versed in politics can look at that and go, that seems a little off. You really said there are no instances I know of where Clinton was doing the bidding of a donor or benefactor. And you expect people to take you seriously. You should have no future in anything involving the news industry because you've proven you can't do your job. And I'm not saying this because, oh, my God, it's PC outrage and she doesn't agree with me, therefore she should have a job. No, I'm saying it because you suck at your job. It's like if I call a plumber because I need a plumber at my place and somebody shows up and I say, okay, here's the problem, and they say, oh, I don't do plumbing. Why the fuck are you here? Why are you in the news business? You clearly don't know what you're doing. Okay. All right. Let me do one more here before we take a break. I'm going to go to the Barbara Streisand one as a random sentence. I realized how funny it was as the words were coming out of my mouth. Then we'll take a break, and I got a lot more stuff for you. Barbara Streisand decided to come to the defense of Hillary Clinton in a particularly facepalm-worthy way. So she tweeted the following. What's the issue about Secretary Clinton getting $225,000 a speech when President Bush 41 and 43 got $1 million and Trump gets $1.25 million? Okay for men, but not for women? No, it's not okay for anybody. There's not a single person who's arguing against Hillary Clinton taking money that hasn't also argued against men taking money and all politicians taking money. The problem is money in politics. The problem is the corrupt system that now makes us effectively an oligarchy, according to political science research, and no longer a democracy. The people never get what they want. It's only the moneyed interest. It's only the rich. It's only the donor class. So when you try to pretend like, oh, yeah, all the people who are against Secretary Clinton taking money, they're for it when men take money. No, you made that up. You made that up. And let's be clear, what you're arguing for here is, well, when a woman decides to be corrupt, then it's okay. But when a man does, well, that might be a problem. Maybe we could argue against that. But Hillary's in a special class. You can't critique her. She's a woman. You can't critique her. She's a woman. Oh, please. You're guilty of what you're accusing others of being guilty of. And they're not guilty of it at all. It's the arguments that people are stooping to in order to defend Hillary Clinton are just mind-numbing. Like, you would think that you would put aside the gender politics and the identity politics for a second, and you would try to understand your opponent's argument. And their argument is, it's crystal clear. Hey, when she takes money from those interests, she's going to do their bidding. And it's not even necessarily her fault. It's the nature of the system. When you set up an incentive structure, people are going to respond to the incentives. And the incentives are, hey, raise money from rich donors and corporations, and then when you're in power, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, or you're done. You're not getting reelected because you're not going to raise money the next time around, so you won't be able to run ads and get your name out there. But no. What's the problem with Hillary taking money from people who inevitably are going to want favors as she ignores the American people? What's the problem with that? It wasn't a problem when men did it. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And I'm not going to give her a special pass because she has a vagina. This is just like the argument she made against Bernie in one of the debates. By definition, I am not part of the establishment because I got a vagina. What now, bitch? This is what she said to Bernie, more or less, except the what now, bitch part. What are you going to do? Look at my genitals. They ain't the same as yours, so I get to do whatever I want. What is this? And I think the most important point here is it besmirches feminism. That's why I call this Mick feminism. It ain't feminism, it's Mick feminism. It's this third wave kind of feminism where you just pull the gender card to get away with other shit. and you pick issues where there are no issues, and you make a mountain out of a molehill, and you say, this is sexism, sexism. You're against Hillary Clinton taking big money and then doing the bidding of those donors? Sexist. Or not, but I know. You can dismiss what I say by definition because I have a penis. I must just be a Bernie bro. It's not that I support Bernie Sanders for literally all of his policy positions. Medicare for all, universal college, getting money out of politics, okay, stopping the wars in the Middle East. It's not that I support him because of that stuff. I must support him because he's a dude and because I'm just so sexist that I can't, you know, consider voting for a woman. That's exactly why I'm against Hillary Clinton. Even though I've already said a million times and I'll say it a million more, I would vote for Elizabeth Warren today if she was running. But that doesn't count. Somehow I'm still a Bernie bro and I'm still sexist, even though I would support Elizabeth Warren for president, because I support Bernie over Hillary. Keep making your ridiculous arguments and people will keep running to Bernie Sanders. That's what's happening right now. All right, I got to take a break. When we come back, got a lot more, including what words does Hillary Clinton use the most and Bernie Sanders use the most. A lot of interesting takeaways. Stay right there.
of a bitch.
All right, guys. Let's do it. Now, before I get into this, I need everybody to, in their heads, imagine what the answers are going to be here. Okay, imagine what Hillary Clinton says the most versus what Bernie Sanders says the most, what phrases they say the most. Just, you know, take a guess, however long shot it is in your mind, and then I'll give you the answers here, and you'll go, oh, of course. Absolutely, I should have known that. All right, let's do it. Nate Silver of 538 decided to compile a list of the phrases repeated most often by Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And I want to go through some of them here and see if we can learn anything. Now, before I go on, I have to say, I told you so. When I say that Bernie Sanders' entire campaign is based on policy substance, and Hillary's is not, and it's more flowery rhetoric. Well, kind of proves it here. So, what are some of Hillary Clinton's top phrases? To do more, how we're going to, I know how, to do everything I can, and that's a separate one, barriers that stand in the way, that's one I mock all the time, I'm going to knock down the barriers that stand in the way. Okay, how? How? Policy substance. No, I'm just going to say the vague thing, and then you'll vote for me. And then I took on the, and those are her, you know, some of her top ones here. Now, Bernie, you ready for this? Health care to all, a corrupt campaign finance system, have more people in jail than any other country, the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, paid family and medical leave, a political revolution, income and wealth, state of Vermont, the minimum wage. Let me just say this. He also has other things in there like a tax on Wall Street speculation, and transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency. So, it's not a question. When you actually crunch the numbers and you do the hard work, this feeling that we have when we watch them, it turns out to be totally true. She's up there and she's like, okay, give me my standard political stump speech and my talking points. And I'll speak in a vague way, in a generalized way, and I'll talk about how, you know, in America, we're the land of equal opportunity, and we need to knock down the barriers holding people back, and we need to do this and do that. And it's never like, hey, here's the bill that I would propose. Here's the specific policy I'm in favor of. With Bernie, it's almost only that. He's like, okay, a single-payer Medicare for all system, and the rest of the modern world has similar systems to that. And what we would do is we would do public funding of a private system, but since it's public funding, that's the single payer, and it's just not, just details oozing out of his pores. Guy's like, okay, $15 minimum wage at the federal level across the board. You know, okay, this is how we're going to transfer over from fossil fuels to energy efficiency. Hey, let me explain to you the dynamics of corruption in the system and the problem with the incentives and how politicians do the bidding of their donors. The fact that anybody could watch these two and think I'm with her, as their hashtag goes, is mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. Because if you care about the policy substance, if you care about – if you're issues-based, if you're a wonk, well, then there is no question. You go, oh, yeah, that guy's talking about it. He's very specific. And she's more, you know, the standard 90s politician of – and actually, to be fair to her, she's not as bad as, like, Martin O'Malley or Marco Rubio. Because they have the politician rhythm and cadence, way of talking, inflection, where, like, it's just everything about it is fake. I think when the way Hillary talks is perfectly fine, and it's really not crazy politician-like, which is good. But what she says is totally politician-like. And then, obviously, whenever she breaks away from that for a little bit, what does she do? She copies Bernie Sanders. Now, I said from the beginning of the campaign she should have done that. Because I think she would already have the nomination locked up if from the beginning of the campaign she just played the Me Too game with Bernie Sanders. Because she already has higher name recognition, she's already a bigger celebrity. So if he goes out there and makes all these great arguments and she's right there to say, I'm going to make the exact same arguments and I agree, well then she already has the bigger name, she would win. But she keeps going back and forth. Half the time she's like, I'm more pragmatic and more moderate and I don't want to do anything near as far as he does. And then she goes down in the polls, and she's like, oh, I mean, I want to do exactly what he does. Then she goes back up in the polls. And so it's been this tug of war. So, but there you have it, man. Now you know. If you take them at their word, he's more policy-focused, she ain't. Okay. And thank you to Tariq for sending that to me. He's a good listener, Secular Talk's been listening for a long time. And this was exactly the kind of story I like doing on the show. Okay, now, I want to talk a little bit about something that I was thinking of, okay, about Bernie's campaign and one of the many reasons why it's resonating. So last night, as I was doing show prep, I started thinking about Bernie's campaign and why it's resonating in a very profound way. And there are 1,000 answers to that question that play a part. But the big one that stuck out in my mind was, he's not afraid of his own liberalism. He owns it. And I think that's such a positive because from 1980 and onwards, no Democrats owned their liberalism. They ran away from it. So for those of you who don't remember, after the Jimmy Carter years, the Democrats suffered some massive defeats. And it was viewed in the general public that, well, the problem is they went too far left. And they were associated with and affiliated with, people thought, these dirty hippies who are trying to ruin the country. And, you know, us traditional Americans don't want to have the long hair and the tie-dye shirts and do drugs all day. So the Democrats are affiliated with them. We don't like that. So we're going to vote for Republicans no matter what. Now, again, on policy substance, I think it's a different issue. I think the Democrats were pretty much right all along on policy substance. But the perception of your average American was they're too far left. Look at who they're in the room with. They're in the room with those dirty hippies. And, you know, the anti-Vietnam people, and people thought that was unpatriotic at the time. So there's a million and one reasons why Democratic politicians thought, and perhaps partially rightfully so, I have to run away from the perception that I'm that. So after the Reagan era and the dominance, so you had 2 terms of Reagan, you had George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton came along. Now, many people don't know because this was early on, and I know I was 28. I wasn't able to follow the stuff at the time since I'm 28 now. When he was running the first time around, there's no way. I was just too young. But he ran as what's called a New Democrat and a third way Democrat. And he portrayed himself as above the fray. He did what's now called, it's the political science term, triangulation, which means he looks at the left, he looks at the right, and he goes, you know, I'm not with these right wingers because I am a Democrat and I believe in liberal values to an extent. But I'm definitely not with these left-wingers either because they're a little too crazy and they're a little too out there. So I'm the adult in the room, and I rise above the fray, and I'm a centrist, and I listen to both sides. And, you know, since I'm more reasonable, vote for me, America. And again, at the time, you can argue that perhaps this is what America needed because the perception was the Democrats are too far left. On policy, I don't think they were, but the perception was because of the fact that they're tied with the hippie movement. People go, oh, that's just too far left. So Bill Clinton comes along. He wins. And then every single Democratic strategist on earth goes, that's it. We're done. Don't think about it anymore. Don't do any more analysis. It's crystal clear. You don't run far left. Look at what happened to Jimmy Carter, some would argue. Look at what happened to the subsequent Democratic candidates. They got their ass handed to them. Reagan destroyed. So they're like, no more seemingly going far left. The answer is always, the Democrats should always triangulate, be a new Democrat, be a centrist, stay in the center. Okay? Stay there. Don't go anywhere. This is where you're staying. So even in a primary, be kind of moderate. In a general, run further to the right, even though you already started out being moderate. So for the longest time, there were no Democrats who were being actual traditional Democrats in the mold of FDR. There just weren't any. The entire Democratic Party sold out to corporations, sold out to big money, and they started using the triangulation approach. Even after George W. Bush, who was a disaster, and he was a far-right winger, and the American people were like, anything but a right-winger now, we're done with the far-right. We still had Democrats who were triangulating and being somewhat centrist. Obama at times appeared liberal. He was certainly to the left of Hillary Clinton. But when you really look at his campaign, was he all that liberal? He didn't even argue for universal health care. So, you know, you look at him and people say, oh, my God, he was so far left. Not really. He kind of ran also a New Democrat triangulation-like campaign that was kind of centrist. So, and people would have voted for the Democrat no matter what after Bush. So let's be clear about that. But now people are sick of it. They want a progressive. They want a liberal. And Hillary Clinton's given us that 1990s kind of Democrat, the triangulation Democrat, because that was the formula for success, and they haven't broken free, and they don't understand that the country's changed. So along comes Bernie Sanders, and what does he do? He goes, not only am I a liberal, I'm a democratic socialist. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get universal health care, single payer for everybody, Medicare for all. I'm going to get universal college. We're going to be like the other modern nations. We're going to be more like Denmark. That's what we're going to do. We're going to raise the minimum wage. We're going to raise it $15 an hour. That's what we're going to do. We're going to get the money out of the political system. Money's corrupt in the political system. It's broken. So here's a guy with a vision. He's FDR 2.0. And he's like, this. I'm telling you what I'm in favor of. Now, you tell me, in today's climate, what resonates more? The old, I'm a new Democrat, I'm a centrist, maybe I'll tweak around the edges sometimes, but maybe not, incremental change, kind of, maybe, I don't know, that's my starting position, then the Republicans will probably beat me back to doing nothing, but this is what I want to do, I want to tiptoe around and tell you this is what I'm in favor of. That, or a guy who comes along and he's like, here is my vision, I have a philosophy, I have this idea of America, this is what I want in place, I want to continue on the project that FDR started. That's what I want to do. I want a new deal for America. What's going to resonate more today? Well, we had George W. Bush. We had the subprime mortgage crisis. We had the Great Recession. We got a centristy Democrat in Obama. People are like, we need more. We need more. They're sick of it. They're up to student debt and to their fucking eyeballs, man. Medical bills is the number one cause of bankruptcy in America. You think they want a new Democrat to come along and say, maybe I'll change that, but maybe not because I'm centrist. I don't want to be too liberal and scare everybody away. So when Bernie argues, no, I am a liberal, okay? I am to the left. People go, finally somebody's saying it. They haven't said it in so fucking long, and now we need it, and now it's here. So that's one of the reasons why he's doing well. And furthermore, people forget that there was a time. I often mock right-wing radio today. In the 1990s, if I was old enough and doing a show at the time, I wouldn't have mocked it. Why? Because at the time, it was a fucking powerhouse. So people forget that it was people like Rush Limbaugh, for example, who effectively demonized the word liberal. And that was pervasive all throughout America, where nobody would even want to say they're a liberal. That's part of the reason why people came up with the term progressive, where they say, well, liberal has been demonized so thoroughly that we'll come up with this new one that basically means the same thing, and it's progressive. But again, Bernie Sanders says, I don't care about any of that. I'm going to double down, and I'm going to tell you you are wrong, and I am right. And people go, oh, it's a fucking breath of fresh air. The guy's keeping it real. The guy's telling us his vision, and he actually stands for something. What the fuck did the other people stand for? Donald Trump being an authoritarian and being a narcissist. Being a fascist. Ted Cruz, theocratic fascism. Even worse, Hillary Clinton. Incremental change, maybe. Pro-corporate, pro-establishment, center-right Democrat. And then there's Bernie. He says, I'm a democratic socialist. I'm a liberal. I'm going to fight. I'm going to fight for you, and this is my philosophy. And people wonder why he's resonating. That's why he's resonating. Okay. Now, we have to go to California here and discuss the good news. This is going to be good, man. I'm happy about this one. So we have some good news coming out of California. California Governor Jerry Brown said on Monday that he reached a deal with top legislators and labor leaders to gradually raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Now, I believe it's by 2022, it'll be $15 an hour for big businesses. By 2023, it's $15 an hour for smaller businesses. So Huffington Post reports here. The latest in a wave of minimum wage increases at the state level following a push by Democrats. The proposal, which still must win approval from moderate lawmakers in the California Assembly, would gradually raise the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour, but give the governor the right to opt out if the economy faltered. Okay. So let me just give you some facts here real quick so you understand the extent of the problem when we talk about this issue. Did you know that the minimum wage would be about $11 an hour today if it simply kept up with inflation since 1968? So what that means is the minimum wage in 1968 was worth more than the minimum wage today is worth. If you worked for the minimum wage in 1968, you were actually richer than you are today if you work for the minimum wage. That is an incredible fact. Again, it'd be about $11 an hour today if it kept up with inflation since 1968. And then also, it would be $21.72 if it kept up with worker productivity. Now, it's a little bit misleading a number because I think that includes technology and the productivity that happens as a result of technological increases. But either way, it's an interesting fact nonetheless that it would be $21.72 if it kept up with worker productivity. We are nowhere near that. We're $7.25 right now. So that's absolutely stunning. Now, I want to come back to this idea that the governor has the right to opt out of it if the economy faltered. I get why they're doing it, okay? Now, a right-wing argument is, hey, if you raise the minimum wage, less people are going to be hired because the business owners don't want to pay that, so they're going to fire more people and unemployment's going to go up. Now, that's only true if it's around the edges. So in other words, if you raise the minimum wage too much, that is indeed true. If you raise it to $25 an hour, well, then there's just small businesses just can't afford that, and they're going to have to lay people off, okay? But if you talk about a little increase, well, then maybe that's not true. And, in fact, we have studies that show that it isn't true, where when you raise it within reason, as long as the businesses can afford it, and if you raise it within reason, they usually can, well, then there isn't going to be a massive uptick in unemployment. So the right-wing argument is true, but only if you raise it too much. And the idea is you have to find that right balance and the right number to raise it. Now, $15, is that the right number? Look, you guys, I've explained this before on air. I'll explain it again today what my idea is for the minimum wage. Now, the debate we seem to be having is at the federal level, should we go to $12 an hour, that's Hillary Clinton's proposal, or $15, which is Bernie Sanders' proposal? And I actually think they're both wrong. So what I mean by that is what I would do if I was emperor for a day is I would say, all right, I need economists in every state to determine what a living wage is in that state. And then whatever the living wage is in each state, that's what the number will be in that state. So in other words, it's federal legislation that mandates the living wage in each state. So in Wyoming, it could be $9.15 because it's just cost of living is much lower there. But in New York, it might be $21. And that's what it would be. And you calculate it that way. Now, the only part where I hesitate even on that is, obviously, it's not going to be – the numbers aren't going to be the same for, like, Syracuse versus New York City. Syracuse is going to be – it would be a much lower living wage. So perhaps you would even need to get more nuance with it, and you'd have to do it by, like, congressional district or something like that, where you make a living wage in each congressional district. And I know that's a lot of work and it's a fucking headache and it's hard to even explain or never mind actually put into law. But the reason why I'm sold on that idea, the idea of doing it more locally but from a federal level, is because I actually don't want to wind up doing the wrong thing here with good intentions and make it so unemployment increases and make it so we actually end up hurting some people who are lower income earners. I'd like to do the right thing, which is give everybody a living wage, but do it the smart way and do it the pragmatic way, where it's a living wage for where they happen to live, and that varies across the country. But either way, so at the end of the day, do I support what they're doing here in California? Yes, I do. Okay, especially because in places like LA, $15, that's probably still barely a living wage, if it is a living wage at all. So I do think it's a step in the right direction. And I'd like to see it pass, and then obviously we'll be able to study and see the effects, and you can tweak proposals one way or the other afterwards. But another interesting part of this, Bernie Sanders threw some shade at Hillary over this, because Hillary tweeted about how, she supports the raise to $15 an hour in California. And he's like, oh, that's interesting. I agree. Here's the difference. I actually support it at the federal level, too. Ooh, waterfall of tweets going after Hillary after that. Ooh. Because it's true. She says, I'm for a $12 minimum wage. And then when somebody does 15, she's like, I like that. Wait, what? But you argued against the $15. And now you're like, I like it because it's politically popular to like it. Now, she does have a way to wiggle out of that. She could say, well, look, at the state level, I'm fine with raising it to whatever you want. But at the federal, I'd make it 12. Yeah, but still, Bernie gets to say, I'm for it across the board, $15. You're not. So he's kind of right in that criticism either way. But this is good news coming out of California. We should all celebrate it. Okay. Do I have time to squeeze in one more before we take a break? I'm right on that bubble, guys. What do you think? No, I'm not going to do it. How about that? So when we come back, there was an attempted terror attack on Capitol Hill that we're going to discuss and we're going to get into detail about. Not getting all that much coverage. It was about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and then gone. President Obama was giving a keynote address this week at an award ceremony, and he weighed in on the issue of political correctness. Yeah, he makes a good point, and he previously made a different good point. So I actually think, weirdly enough, the president's exactly where I am on this issue of political correctness. So I want to talk about his comments. And then later on in the show, like I mentioned at the top of the show, we have a UN summit being held on international drug policy. And apparently there are some big names that are signing on to this, and that could be a sign of the snowball effect to come. And also, BDS is working, so obviously I'm an anti-Semite for even mentioning that. And a Catholic priest in Canada is being investigated because he did one of the most grotesque scams you'll ever hear of coming out of the church. Actually, that's not true. I bite my tongue. Perhaps the most grotesque scandal coming out of the church is mass child fucking, when it was the Catholic Church. I'll give you that. This is not as bad as mass child fucking, but it's pretty fucking bad. And it's getting to the point where countless religious scandals. Could it be that religious ideology and faith in and of itself is kind of a little bit of an issue? And you should move away from accepting things with no evidence whatsoever. Again, I must be a bigot for pointing out something like that. Anyway, let's take a break here. When we come back, we'll cover all that stuff and much more. Stay right there. Blog Talk Radio, Secular Talk Radio, Kyle Klinsky Show. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
son of a bitch. All right, people. We back.
All right. Let's talk about the attempted terror attack yesterday. Okay. There was an attempted terror attack on Capitol Hill yesterday, but luckily it was foiled by the police. The Daily Beast reports here, a gun was drawn at the Capitol Visitors Center on Monday. At a press conference outside the Capitol, U.S. Capitol Police Chief Matthew Verderosa said the suspect drew what appeared to be a weapon and pointed it at officers during routine screening at the visitor center at 2:38. One officer fired and struck the suspect, who is undergoing surgery at the hospital. His condition is unknown. A weapon was recovered at the scene. The perpetrator was known to police thanks to a previous incident at the Capitol in 2015. He yelled, "I'm a prophet of Allah," from the balcony of the House of Representatives. So he was later arrested for assault as well. And this is a scary thing. Now, when you watched the news the other day, there was only coverage for about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, where they were talking about the incident, and then they just moved right along. You would think that with an attempted terror attack at the Capitol, that it would perhaps get a little bit more coverage, and it would be huge news. Oh, my God, has a cell infiltrated? What's going on here? Is this going to happen again? How good are our security measures at the Capitol? And the list goes on and on. Not much coverage. Now, why is that? Because there's one little detail here that I tweaked for you so that it would change the nature of this story. The guy did not say, "I'm a prophet of Allah," from the balcony of the House of Representatives. He said, "I'm a prophet of God." And his name is not Abdullah. His name is Larry Dawson. And he's Christian. He's not a Muslim. So think about this for a second. Imagine it really was a Muslim who did it. Imagine it was a Muslim who said, "I'm a prophet of Allah." And then he was arrested for assault, and then now he comes and he pulls out a gun and points at officers, and he gets shot. Oh, my God, people was, ISIS infiltrated! It's ISIS! Oh, my God, it's ISIS, it's jihadists, they made their way to the Capitol, let's all be afraid. But when it's Larry Dawson, now, you know, some people might say, come on, Kyle, you're making too big a deal out of this. But remember, we covered it on the show just yesterday. Another story that shows this kind of bias where we don't care as much when it's not carried out by a Muslim. There was a guy who said to an Islamic center, "I'm going to come and kill all of you. I'm going to do that." And then police found that he had bombs, homemade bombs, that he was going to use. And they had to detonate him. They were at his place, so he was going to do it. Now they caught him. What did this guy get? 3 months, plus probation. It's like Robert Duggar, remember that guy? He was a politician who ran, I believe it was in Arizona, and he said, "I'm going to go to a Muslim community in New York, and I'm going to slaughter everybody. I'm going to kill the civilians. I'm going to chop them up with my machete. I have a plan of attack laid out." What happened with that guy? He got out on probation. So that guy's walking the streets. Again, just flip the victim and the perpetrator here. You know that guy would be locked up, and he'd be locked up for a very long time. Rightfully so. The thing is, I would like them locked up for a very long time, and I would like equal media coverage, whether it's the perpetrator's Christian, whether it's Islamic, whether it's a right-winger, whether it's a liberal. Whether it's a liberal. And in this case, there's actually some evidence the dude might be a liberal. Because he, one of the things that he did is he went to Capitol Hill previously because he really wanted to push for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Okay, so here we have a person who's perhaps liberal on some issues who says that he thinks he's a prophet of God and he went to go kill people. Yeah, lock that motherfucker up and lock him up for a long time and cover it in the media the same way you would cover any other terrorist incident, but they don't do it. They don't do it. They don't do it. Because in the mind of the mainstream media, it's only worth harping away on and talking about a deeper issue if Muslims are involved. Now, again, in the U.S., I think it's 56% of terror attacks and attempted terror attacks are done by right-wingers. And you wouldn't know that watching the news, because the only time they call it a terror attack is when it's a Muslim. So when it's sovereign citizens, or when it's neo-Nazis or the KKK, though admittedly neo-Nazis and KKK don't do nearly as much as sovereign citizens and other right-wing groups that are specifically politics-oriented, there's just not nearly as much coverage. So I would just like equal, treatment, and objective treatment is the best way to put it. Because sometimes the reality isn't equal, and in that case, it shouldn't be equal. But I just want objective coverage, and I want to use the terms properly. So if it's terrorism when Muslims do a bombing for religious reasons or political reasons, it's terrorism when, a white person does a shooting for political reasons or religious reasons. They even called Dylann Roof a terrorist. Dylann Roof was a neo-Confederate. There's pictures of him with, flags of apartheid South Africa or Rhodesia. There's flags of him holding the Confederate flag. There's pictures of him holding the Confederate flag. So, yeah, that's clearly a terrorist, but no, we can't call him a terrorist because he's white. I just want objectivity. And guys, don't misunderstand what I'm saying here, because some people try to misconstrue this and say, oh, he's downplaying it when it's Muslim terrorism. No, I'm not. Go and look at every segment I've done after every Muslim terror attack, and I talk about it, and I talk about it in detail, okay? I just want objectivity. So yes, it's fair to say, hey, from Muslim fundamentalists, so from ISIS, Al-Qaeda, jihadist groups, they pose more of an existential threat than internal right-wing terror does, because their MO is more likely to involve trying to sneak a nuke into Washington, D.C. Yeah, that's true, and that's a fair conversation to have, and that's not, you're not bigoted, you're not, being biased if you have that conversation. That's just true. But it's also, the other facts count too. It counts when this guy does what would be called a terror attack if a Muslim does it, but since he's not a Muslim, well, now it's not a terror attack, and they just call it a shooting. Well, that's not accurate. So I just want accuracy, and I just want objectivity across the board. Okay, and that requires talking about everything in context and talking about it properly. Yes, ISIS is a tremendous problem. Islamic fundamentalism is on the rise. Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, we notice all that, and we should talk about that in detail. We also should talk about stuff like this and be objective with our terms and use them properly. All right. Next. Go to President Obama and his thoughts on political correctness. He has some more for us. So President Obama was giving a keynote address this week at an award ceremony, and he weighed in on the issue of political correctness. Now, recently he lashed out at what's happening on college campuses, and he lamented the, quote, shutdown of debate. So that was an interesting story. We covered it at the time, and I gave him credit because I said, oh, what he's doing is he's standing up against, what's often referred to as the authoritarian left, and what's referred to as, in a derisive way, SJWs, social justice warriors. I largely agree with him on that, because it is true that when, you have movements where people talk about, I need a safe space, and they don't want to critique, they don't want to have an argument in the realm of ideas on a college campus. Well, I say, well, you missed the whole point of an education system. You're supposed to be challenged. You're supposed to debate the ideas. Safe space is your dorm room. You shouldn't, you try to protect yourself from being challenged intellectually anywhere else on campus. Okay, so I agree with him on that. I agree, people often talk about the words you're not allowed to say. Oh, you're triggering me with, if you say America is a meritocracy, that's a microaggression and you need to not fucking say that. Well, look, I don't agree. I don't think America is a meritocracy. I've made detailed arguments as to why I think it's factual that it's not a meritocracy. But that doesn't mean that if somebody else says it, that I call it a microaggression or say they're triggering me, and I shut down debate and say, you're not even allowed to say that. That's just childish. And actually, if anything, it makes you look like you have the weaker argument when you don't. Because when your response is to sidestep the issue and say, you can't say that, well, then call what it is, you're a little bitch. Okay? You don't want to have the conversation. So I agree with Obama when he talks about, oh, come on, the shutdown of debate on college campuses, that's a problem, that's not right. Well, now he came out and he's giving the other half of the picture. Okay. He says, political correctness is increasingly an excuse to say offensive things or to lie. Now, that's actually similar to the line that I've been using. A line which, by the way, fucking Marco Rubio stole. Now, to be fair to Marco Rubio, I don't think he actually heard me say it, and then he took it after he heard me say it. I just think somebody in his campaign came up with it, or he came up with it, but I'm the one who clearly used it first, as I've been using it for probably over a year now. I like to say that some people think they're being politically incorrect, but they're just being incorrect. There's a difference. And this is what he's trying to get at here. Now, I actually would have worded it differently if I were him, because he said political correctness is increasingly an excuse to say offensive things or to lie. I would say take out the offensive part, because I don't care about offense. It's one of those things where, oh, I'm so offended. Well, it depends. The thing you're offended by, is it true and you don't like it and then you're offended? Or is it not true and you're offended by how untrue it is? Because if it's the former, well, I don't care. You know, so you can say, I'm offended by it, but if it's true, piss off. I don't care about your offense. Shove it up your ass. So I wouldn't have said the offensive part, but I do think he's right when he says political correctness is increasingly an excuse to lie or to say things that are flat out not true. Case in point, Donald Trump and Coulter. They're the two perfect examples. You know, Ann Coulter loves to say bombastic things and loves to agree with Trump. Let's kick out all the immigrants. Let's ban all Muslim immigrants from coming to the country. And then when you say, hey, you might be a bigot, they go, oh, my God, this, you're just being politically correct. No, I'm being correct. If you say, let's kick out all undocumented immigrants, when the overwhelming majority of them are working hard, they're good people, they're not criminals, well, then there's got to be a reason why you're saying to kick them out. And that reason may be tied to their demographic makeup. When you say with Muslims, ban all of them from entering the country, well, then you're saying, I'm going to treat Sufi Muslims, I'm going to treat Ahmadi Muslims, I'm going to treat Baha'i, I'm going to treat all the different overtly peaceful, sects of Islam as just as bad as Salafi jihadists. Well, then you are a bigot because you're saying they're all the same. I am going to generalize, keep them all out. So they think they're keeping it real. They think they're being politically incorrect, but they're just incorrect. It's like when Trump says, we got to go after the families of ISIS in the Middle East. Okay, no, Donald, that's not politically incorrect. That's incorrect. You want to massacre civilians. That's terrorism. You want to purposefully target civilians. That's a war crime. That's a war crime. But Ann Coulter and Donald Trump, I'm just keeping it real. No, you're not. You're keeping it stupid. You're keeping it cretinous and wretched and odious. And no decent American should look at that and say, oh, yeah, I'm with that because he's telling it like it is. That's not telling it like it is. That's being a fucking savage. It's being a barbarian. That's saying, I will counter ISIS by being almost exactly like them. Instead of beheading you, I'll just shoot a Scud missile at your face. Oh, well, how enlightened you are. So I think Obama's actually right on both counts here. He's right about the shutdown of debate on college campuses and how that's a problem and how the authoritarian left is a real thing and, you know, we should stand up to that. But he's also right that oftentimes when right-wingers invoke, you're being politically correct, no, we're not being politically correct. We're being correct when we say certain things, talk about policy issues, talk about morality and ethics, and we need to be able to be balanced in that. And unfortunately, today, I see a lot of polarization. So you're either in the crowd that there's no such thing as political correctness and there's no such thing as the authoritarian left at all and there's nothing to talk about here, or you're in the crowd of, you know, the biggest problem in the world is political correctness and I will use that as an excuse to be a right-wing prick. Well, both sides are wrong there and there's a rational middle ground, and I actually think President Obama hit the nail on the head. Okay. Next. Let's go to what's happening in Israel. Haaretz is reporting on the effects of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, also known as BDS, which protests the Israeli occupation. They say, quote, responding to international boycott pressures and other constraints, a growing number of Israeli companies operating in the West Bank are moving their facilities to locations within the country's internationally recognized borders, according to a report prepared by an anti-occupation organization that monitors such activities. The report obtained by Haaretz shows that, aside from the recent high-profile cases like SodaStream, the seltzer machine manufacturer, other prominent Israeli companies have also been part of this trend, even if they have managed to evade publicity. So, you ready for the numbers? They say roughly 20 to 30% of the companies that were in the West Bank in occupied territories are now gone. BDS is working. That's what that means. Now, people probably wonder, why is it that all of a sudden there's this massive backlash? Netanyahu talks about it. Hillary Clinton spoke about it in her speech to AIPAC. This is something people, oh my God, they're really concerned about it now. Well, they're concerned about it because it's fucking working. Why is it working? It's working because you have the moral high ground and you keep it. You're not trying to end occupation by guns now when you do it this way. You're trying to end it through economic pressure. You're trying to end it through boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. So you keep the moral high ground. It's obvious you have the moral high ground. And then eventually, you're going to actually squeeze people who are well off in Israel, and then they turn to the government, and they press the government. I'm losing money like a motherfucker here. You're going to have to do something to fix this problem and to make it so the boycotts stop, because I can't keep losing money. And if this, hey, if we got to make some kind of two-state deal, as long as it allows us to not have our economy squeezed anymore, fine, we'll do it. We'll do it. We'll do it. So it's working. And that's why they're screaming about it now more than ever. And that's why there's this new campaign where it's, just link it to anti-Semitism. Anybody who supports BDS, by definition, hates all Jews. Well, that's as ridiculous as an Islamist saying, if you criticize verses in the Quran, you're an Islamophobe. You're an anti-Muslim bigot because you disagree with verses in the Quran, like semen comes from your backbone, or in the Hadith, like Jews turn to apes over time. You're a bigot because you won't accept my bigotry. That's what this is like. This is exactly like that. Somehow now anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Wanting to stop occupation, oppression, and apartheid means you hate all Jews. That's what I like to call a pathetic dodge. A pathetic dodge. And now we know why they're making those desperate arguments. They're getting desperate. It also hurts when the entire international community is against you. And they're like, okay, no, stop. Stop doing it. I love how when people point to the number of, condemnations from the UN against Israel, as if it's evidence that, like, obviously every major country on earth is just massively anti-Semitic. Or maybe there's a little something going on that we should address, like occupation, apartheid. Maybe that's what they're mad about. Now, there is one criticism that I think makes sense when people say, yeah, but wait, how is it you're criticizing Israel more than, for example, Saudi Arabia, which is a Wahhabi terror state, which, you know, says all atheists are terrorists, they behead people for drug smuggling, and all these insane crimes that are not crimes. That I agree with them on. But the answer is not criticize Israel less and go softer on occupation and apartheid. No. The answer is criticize Saudi Arabia more. That's what the answer is. The answer is get them off the fucking human rights panel. They don't know dick about human rights. They're one of the biggest human rights violators on the planet, okay? But that's the answer. The answer is you criticize Saudi Arabia more, you criticize Iran more, you criticize the U.S. more, honestly, because we fucking did, we had a torture program. You know, we waged an illegal war that killed minimum 200,000 civilians in Iraq. It was the wrong country. So there's more condemnation should fly around, not less on Israel. Oh my God, hold back because you must be anti-Semitic, or not. Or you're just fucking dodging the fact that there's occupation, there's oppression, there's apartheid going on there. So, yes, BDS is the answer. Of course it's the answer. We know it's the answer because it worked with South Africa. In South Africa, they had a horrendous situation. You put enough economic pressure on them. All of a sudden, did we say no peace? Let's try to make a deal. Exactly. That's fucking exactly right. Now, let's also be clear about one other thing. Are there some people affiliated with BDS who would want right to return? I'm sure. I'm sure there are. Are they going to get that, and are they right to want that? No and no. So part of any peace deal is understanding Israel has a right to exist, of course. It's just a matter of where you draw the borders and what kind of two-state deal you have. And what's generally understood as the most reasonable deal, the best compromise, would be the 67 borders. I like the idea of building a big wall to separate them. You split up Jerusalem, and you have international recognition for both sides. That, I think, is a proper peace deal moving forward. So to say that, hey, there are people in BDS who want more than that, therefore it's anti-Semitic, is absolutely absurd. And it's as ridiculous as saying that, you know, somebody on the Israeli side who wants more than what they have now, by definition, they are also, you know, anti-Muslim bigots or anti-Palestinian. No, we get it. There are people on both sides who are bigots and do want all the land, and there are people on both sides who are not bigots and still want all the land. And then there are people who are more reasonable and voices of moderation who can come together and make a deal. And since Netanyahu has been so obstinate in his refusal to do a deal, well, then now the answer is, all right, so we're going to force your punk ass into a deal. How you like them apples? And that's what BDS is succeeding at. 20 to 30% of the companies leaving? Keep going, and that number is going to keep ticking up. And then eventually we'll sit down at the table, we'll get a deal, and it will be done the right way. It'll be done in the way that's not unethical, it's not immoral, it's not counterproductive when Hamas tries to do violence. It'll be done in the right way, where you have the moral high ground, you stay peaceful, and you use economic pressure to get the proper outcome. Let's continue here. We have 10 minutes. See if I can squeeze in two more. Probably can. There's a UN summit being held next month on international drug policy, and The Economist is reporting on some welcome developments here. So they say, as the drug war has rumbled on with little to show for all the money and violence, its critics have become a more diverse bunch than the hippies and libertarians who first backed drug reform. Now, five former presidents of Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, Nigeria, and Switzerland, as well as former Deputy Prime Minister of Britain, are looking to speak out. All right, that's huge, man. Five heads of state are going, yeah, had a good run, but this whole drug war thing ain't working out. So what this shows you is it's part of the snowball effect. It always starts with something little. Just a little thing here and there. And then eventually, oh, there's a little crack in the foundation. Oh, look, the crack's getting bigger. And then you look in the U.S., for example. We got Colorado. We got Washington State. We got Alaska. The ball's rolling. We got over 20 states, I believe, that have medical marijuana, which in many cases, keep it real, is just a guise for people actually to use recreational weed. But again, I support that. Go ahead. I'm in favor of recreational weed. But bottom line is the ball started rolling, and now you can't stop it. And there's been mounting pressure at the U.N., at the international level in general, where people are like, oh, this is really bad. This drug war thing is not working out. And all it takes is a cursory understanding of the facts to go, oh, we have a problem here. Because it's the same thing as prohibition. I know people get tired of me bringing up this example, but I bring it up because it's true. When prohibition was going on in the U.S. and you weren't allowed to drink alcohol was illegal, what happened? Alcohol didn't just go away. It was still there. You just pushed it underground to the black market. And when it's on the black market, who had a monopoly on the product, alcohol, and got incredibly, incredibly wealthy off of it? The mafia. So it was prohibition, which was largely pushed for by the KKK, by the way, which led to the rise of the mafia and made the mafia the powerhouse that it became. And then what happens when you end prohibition? Well, over time, that mafia, not very powerful anymore. They had to move into different markets and try different things, and they didn't have that same cash flow. It's the same fucking thing for drug cartels, man. If you were to legalize, tax, and regulate drugs, you can have some growing operations in the U.S. You can have it, you know, contained here. The Mexican drug lords are going to lose all their money. Many of the cartels would go out of business. So if you want to stop the drug cartels and the associated violence, Well, you legalize, you tax, and you regulate. And furthermore, we spent $1 trillion, over $1 trillion, on the drug war. Today, kids are more likely to try drugs than they were back then. So the same amount of drug use, even more drug use, and you took $1 trillion and flushed it down the toilet. What are you doing? Never mind, thousands of people have died because it's a literal drug war. The answer is so obvious. At the very least, you decriminalize, but you should legalize, tax, and regulate. And then when people have problems with drugs, because they will, right? About 20% of all drug users have a problem. 80% are usually moderate users, no matter what the drug is. Well, then you give those people help. It's a medical problem. Don't put them in a fucking cage, lock them up, and throw away the key, and, you know, give us the a prison population that's bigger than any other country on the planet. More people are in prison in the U.S. than Stalin had in his gulags at their height. But you don't do that. You give them rehab. You give them addiction help. You treat it like a medical issue. So we know what the answers are, and now we're just starting to get to the point where the snowball is picking up speed. So we'll see, man. But what's so frustrating is that all of us know what the right answer is. It's clear what the right answer is. But we're sitting – there's this big machine – you know, this system that we're in, this global system, and it's like everything goes so fucking slowly, and you got to drag the idiots to agree with you and say, hey, here are the facts, and they don't care about facts because they're ideologues. And it's like, just give us the right policy already. We know what the answer is, and your punk asses are slowing it up. Well, hopefully it'll speed up now. Okay. And finally, one more, and we might even finish a wee bit early, lass. A Catholic priest in Canada is being investigated by police because he may have gambled away $500,000 meant to help refugees. Oh, what a dick. What a dick. So Vice News reports, in early March, local media reported that Father Amer Saka at the St. Joseph Chaldean Church had been suspended amid allegations that he misappropriated funds. The Toronto Star now says the total amount lost is $500,000. Saka had been collecting deposits for 3 years from members of his parish as well as non-members who wanted to bring their relatives over from Iraq as refugees. The Chaldean Church, based in Baghdad, represents Catholics from Iraq and the surrounding region. All right, think about how low this is. This dude's collecting money from people at church, telling them, oh, we're going to get your family members over here from Iraq. That's what we're going to do. And you got to give me money, and then we're going to go take care of that. What does he do? He takes the money, he goes to the casino, blows $500,000. Good googly moogly. Now, you know, this story goes to show you, just like virtually every story we've ever done on religion, it can be used for either thing. Oftentimes, there are good people who take their religion, they look at the good parts, they believe the good parts, and they act on that, and they try to bring about peace in the world. Malala Yousafzai, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the list goes on and on. Then oftentimes, there are people who look at the shitty verses, and they're fundamentalists, and they say, this is the part that we're going to implement, and then you get your KKK, then you get your Al-Qaeda, and the like. And then there's people like this, where they're just using the religion to dupe people over for nefarious purposes. Now, I don't know whether he started out when he went into it like, I'm going to be a bad person and do this now, or if he actually meant well and he wanted to do it, but then he had a problem and he kept going to the tables and doing it and he couldn't stop himself, but he felt bad about it the whole time. I don't know, but either way, I don't like it. And honestly, what came to my mind when I was reading this was the Catholic child fucking scandal. How, you know, you have that aspect of it, and then you have the aspect of it where you have charity and you have people who tithe and are good people and they try their best to live decent lives, and you have this dichotomy. You have the horrific aspects of religion and how it's used to dupe people over and how it's used to be fundamentalist and restrict people socially, and then there's the positive aspect of it. But here we have a clear example of a dude who ended up being a loathsome dude, and then he actually ended up going to rehab for his gambling addiction. Unfortunately, I don't know if these people are going to get their money back, and that's a devastating angle to the story as well. All right, guys. I'm out of time. I got the countdown in my ear skis. I will see you tomorrow back here. Same time, same place. Everybody enjoy the rest of your day. Much love. Mwah. Peace.